Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 7th. We sit down with the new University of Hawaii Manoa Chancellor. It was a position the UH system did without for many years. What will the reorganization bring? Infighting at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is nothing new, but has it reached new lows? A legal dispute gets ugly. And we meet one of the only street psychiatrists in the nation. He's been recognized for his care and compassion. Plus, we revisit a conversation about a film that's being showcased at the Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival this weekend, Queer Love During the Plantation Era.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting psychedelic funk band Pigeons Playing Ping Pong this Friday and Saturday in two shows nightly. Tickets and packages at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Vasilis Sirmos has been on the job as Manoa Chancellor for a week now. He has been with the University of Hawaii for almost 3.5 decades. And during that time, he has seen how the system navigated with and without a chancellor. He goes into the job with his eyes wide open. He has watched others navigate the minefields and the landscape at the legislature and the Board of Regents. Can he avoid the missteps of others? And what's his plan moving forward? Sirmos dropped by this morning to share his vision during a time when the Trump administration has cut funds in higher education.
Actually, President Lassner was doing both jobs and had delegated a lot of these functions to system administration. And then some of the functions were done by the provost at UH Manoa. And though the job was done, I personally believed, even when system and Manoa came together, I always believe that Manoa needs its own chancellor, its own identity. It is a pretty large Research One flagship institution, and you do need a chancellor to provide the vision, direction, a mission, and provide the experience and the guidance for the campus.
Well, you know, because you are also vice president of academic research, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know what we're dealing with and the challenges that this administration, you know, has rolled out.
Yes.
Right?
They're interesting times, both in the academic enterprise of every institution in the country, not just here at UH Manoa, but also in the research enterprise of every institution. A lot of funding has disappeared or, you know, eliminated, and a lot of the work that usually the university has done in the past and we're very good at, it's not a priority for this administration. Having said that, I have to give a lot of credit to our faculty for reskilling, retooling, actually doing the work still and be able to still bring some substantial research funding within the university.
Yes, and we have increased our research dollars.
Yes, so our research dollars, let's just say when I started back in 2013, the vice president for research office was $375 million. Last year, we closed at almost $750 million. So we doubled our extramural portfolio within 12 to 13 years. So that's a great accomplishment. And most of that credit goes to the faculty and the great work we do. They do with our students and also our staff, because our staff is a big part of our research enterprise.
There was a lot of hand-wringing when some of these pullbacks, you know, were issued. And I know there was something wrapped up with the, I think, the administration of some of the research dollars. So where did we end up with that?
So some of our Title III, and that is the money we get for our Native Hawaiian programs, are ending September 30th, which is the end of the federal fiscal year. So those are going to end. However, the university has made a decision to take some of the most successful programs and institutionalize them and provide them with the funding to continue to do the good work that they do. And then we have some programs, especially on the climate change and environmental sciences, that the funding has dried up, if you will. Those programs, we're looking to see whether we can support through philanthropy. Our philanthropy numbers are up across the university. So the good work keeps on going, but we have some challenges ahead of us. But I think at the end of the day, we will overcome this one too.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of emphasis on climate change and, you know, but projects that were tied, you know, let's say to the DOD with wave energy or those kinds of things. I mean, I know that's taken a back seat.
Yeah, so some of those projects have taken as you said, a backseat, or they're not funded as vibrantly as they used to be in the past. But I think we still have some programs going. On this point, I want to actually acknowledge and give a lot of credit to our congressional delegation, which they have stepped up every time we had issues with our federal funding because of terminations or stop work order. We would work very closely with them, and we would be able to restore some of these programs. So huge kudos to them for working with us and being able, most of the times, to be successful in restoring most of those programs.
Well, I know there's been a lot of emphasis to build up, you know, the Seymour Lab, the microbial work and the research that is really groundbreaking, right?
So microbial oceanography within the UH Manoa is probably one of the gems of research and scholarship we conduct there. Professor Carl, who is our member of the National Academy of Science, is the director of the Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education. Some of that funding has gone away. We're fortunate to have some philanthropic funding for these activities. But we're looking to retool the Seymour and try to bring it to a different level. We're talking with Dave and the researchers in the School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology and see how we can refresh the Seymour and try to restore the funding that they don't have right now.
Well, you know, while there's been some pullback then on climate research, there's been a big push for artificial intelligence, and I know the president has talked about we need to hit this hard. And so how do you see working that into what Manoa does?
Yeah, so the AI is here to stay, and everybody has an opinion about AI, but what I think that everybody should do at least is engage and make a decision by their own experiences. So for UH Manoa, it's going to be a little bit different. I am a strong believer of place-based innovation. It's also called sovereign AI. So it is AI that uses local infrastructure and local talent to actually provide solutions that they have been discovered here locally for global problems. So rather than doing AI just for AI, I think we should actually use the place-based knowledge that we have and apply AI on that. So things like rural health, a huge issue within the state. You see the governor has gone out there. He has actually brought in $189 million this year for rural health. So these are projects that we think AI is going to have a positive effect, how you do rural health and how you can actually supplement the medical professionals with AI. That is a great application of AI. Another one that we have seen is on the manufacturing area, advanced manufacturing area. So AI and advanced manufacturing is another area that the state is putting a lot of resources. So the university comes behind the state to actually anchor these projects. These projects are very significant, both in the commercial shipyard industry, but also the DoD shipyard industry. So very nice dual-use technology type of activity.
We often hear a lot about indigenous knowledge. So it's like, how do you bridge that knowledge, native knowledge from across the Pacific, right, into this new era of AI?
And, and that's why I call it sovereign AI. It could be indigenous or Native Hawaiian place-based AI. So when I was in my previous job as the vice president for research, I had created the first Office of Indigenous Innovation in any R1 institution within the country. And the purpose of that office is exactly what you mentioned, Kathy. It was to actually weave indigenous knowledge to Western science and learn from each other. And we have so many examples of that. You see the fish ponds, all the good work that Dr. Winters is doing at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. So these are projects that we're very proud of. And I think we can export that knowledge because this is knowledge that is created here locally. However, it can be applied globally with great effects.
We've been hearing from UH Chancellor Vasilis Sirmos, and we'll have more from this interview right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violinist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Agano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bethia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Ho'olanapua, working to prevent child trafficking through public education about buyer demand and the community's role in reducing exploitation. Resources at ho'olanapua.org.
Let's return to a conversation this morning with Vasilis Sirmos. The UH Board of Regents named him Chancellor for the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He is no stranger to higher education in Hawaii and hopes to parlay that experience. He is 1 week into the job. You know, you talk about rural health, and I know that the university has been really focused on growing the workforce, right? There's so many areas in healthcare that we just need more people, out there working.
You're absolutely correct. Workforce development within the healthcare is probably one of the top priorities, not only for UH Manoa, but for UH system. And when we talk workforce development, healthcare, most people think about doctors. Yes, doctors are a big part of that, but it's also nurses, physician assistants, radiologist technician, all type of professions within the healthcare and allied health. So we are pushing the envelope on that. We are having a couple of new initiatives. Actually, the money I mentioned before that the state secured for rural health, a big part of that is coming to the university, around $50 to $60 million. And a part of that, it is for workforce development, and JAPSM is the lead for that project.
It's just interesting to see where we can grow people who we need to be out there, and then also use technology in the areas that we can. Be smart about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I was in a conference in Hong Kong at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and there was a pretty interesting discussion about AI and how has it affected workforce development and actually the job market at this time. So now a lot of employers, when they're trying to interview an individual, not only they interview the individual, but they ask you to bring your AI agent, which is pretty much your digital twin, and try to question your digital twin to understand how good of a job you have done understanding AI yourself. So it's going to be a totally different job market out there. I don't think AI will eliminate jobs. On the contrary, I think it will add jobs. They're going to be different jobs. So we have the responsibility to actually provide our students with the tools that they can respond to that change, that workforce change.
You know, I was in the Bay Area recently and struck up a conversation with someone who had said that the school that I went to at Santa Clara, that they were starting a medical school with Sutter Health. And it was just interesting to see, you know, where institutions are putting their money in, you know, for growth.
Yeah. So healthcare is an industry that will grow in the future. Here in Hawaii, we live more than the average person in the continent. So healthcare becomes expensive and needs a lot of resources, both technology-wise and human-wise, as people get older. So it is a great industry, but it is also a very expensive industry. So how we deal with Medicare and Medicaid and how the reimbursement system works, that is also something that our healthcare industry is struggling, as you've seen currently, and they're trying to solve some of these problems but by reorganizing the healthcare sector.
Engineering is your background, but is there any, I don't know, particular area of research that personally excites you?
Yeah, actually, for me, believe it or not, the last 10 years, I have been introduced to conservation and natural resource management. And though it's not engineering, it's totally different. I have been fascinated of the work that the university does in all kinds of activities, conservation to native species, to prevention, to biosecurity, biocontrol. And at the end of the day, we are an island community. And we have to protect what we have here, and we have to protect against invasive species coming into this state. So extremely important work and fascinating work that I have seen the last 10 years.
Can you share a story of maybe you were out in the field and you saw something that just blew your mind?
I can share the stories. I was fortunate enough to know the people at the Oahu National, the Army National...
The Natural Area Reserve?
Reserve.
Yes.
And
amazing research they do out there.
Amazing research, and going out there and see how they do replanting of native plants and how they actually protect the areas by fencing, how actually they do flyovers to understand the impact of invasive species. That is something that I really appreciate, and it's really very exciting. And something that in order to do that work is not just a job. You got actually to want to do this job. It is fascinating to me.
And then where do we go? If we look at our strengths at the university, you know, marine science, obviously, but also astronomy, right?
Yeah.
And there's struggles about what to do about Mauna Kea and where we go with that, but just incredible research.
So, yes, incredible research in astronomy. We are probably one of the best institutions, usually in the top three institutions in the world, not just in the nation. Physical and astronomy, we do a lot of instrumentation, a lot of optics. We create a lot of mirrors and a lot of devices going up to the telescopes. So astronomy is an important area. It is something that the university is extremely well known. It has to be resolved at some point with Mauna Kea. At this time is with the Mauna Kea Authority, and they have to actually take the ball and run now. So the university is providing the runway and the resources for them to go ahead. So astronomy is a critical industry, not only for the university, but the whole state. And then the other one, as you mentioned, it is we are an ocean state, so oceanography, ocean sciences, marine biology. And then you go to sea level rise, climate change. And because we are an island state, you look at issues like water, energy, things that we're extremely good at. And the university has a substantial role to play, not only because of the work we do, but because of the state we live in.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners just about what you hope to achieve as you step into this position?
So for me, you know, I've been here for a long time, Kathy, you know, that 35 years. So what I would like to achieve in my tenure is to improve the student experience and improve the image and the reputation of the institution, not outside the state, but inside the state. This is probably one of the best research institutions and academic institutions in the continent. It is a premier flagship global institution. And at the end of the day, it should be an institution of choice, a destination of choice for our local students and also for students from the continent and internationally. It is one of the best institutions I've known of.
All right. Okay. Well, Mr. Sirmos, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Kathy.
We've been hearing from Basilis Sirmos, who has been tapped to serve as Chancellor of the UH Manoa campus. He previously served as Vice President of Research and Innovation of the UH system. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs is struggling with internal politics and a power play that has erupted in the legal space. Honolulu Civil Beat has a story about the latest wrangling over the departure of its CEO and a very messy lawsuit. Reporter Blaise Lovell joins us with the story. Good morning, Blaise.
Hi, good morning, Catherine.
Yes, so the story came out of a meeting on Monday that I was surprised when I read your story, because I would have thought some of this would have been handled in exec session.
It typically is, but the board wasn't able to make it into executive session because they're blocked by a group of four trustees that have kind of split from the board in terms of how they're defending themselves from this lawsuit. So to, you know, kind of understand and lay the groundwork for what's happening today, we've got to back up a few months. In many ways, this is a feud between the chairman of the board, Kai Kahele, and the CEO, Stacey Ferreira. It kind of stems from OHA's budget process last year, where Kahele introduced a number of changes that caught staff off guard. Ferreira, when she sued, would later say that the budget actually benefited some organizations over others. That's at least what she alleges. After that budget was settled, Ferreira reported Kahele to the board and to other state authorities. There was an internal report, which we haven't been able to see yet. And after that came out, Kahele then lodged his own complaint against Ferreira in September, and the board voted to put her on leave. She subsequently sued. And, you know, this feud was taken into court. But in April, that's when some of the Board of Trustee members began disagreeing with the way the office was handling the case, and they went out and got their own attorney. And things are kind of proceeding as normal until a couple weeks ago, when those four trustees filed court documents that essentially sided with Ferreira and kind of undermined the office's ability to defend itself. And that's where we ended up today and yesterday with that meeting.
Yeah, I mean, this is very serious stuff, you know, because, you know, OHA is, you know, has so many fingers, you know, in the pie, you know, trying to get certain projects through. And I just don't understand how the office can, you know, move forward with all this dysfunction.
Yeah, this is coming at a really high stakes time for the office. You know, Trustee Kirkwood Galateria noted that OHA is on the cusp of pushing forward a lot of these projects. They're about to get an influx of cash from the legislature. You know, he said that they need to play the long game, and people are watching, the public's watching, the legislature is watching, and this isn't something that they, you know, want to fumble at this time.
Yeah, and, you know, it is disconcerting. I mean, I know dysfunction is nothing new at OHA. I've covered many contentious meetings. You know, I think there were disputes over, you know, the fax machine, and each trustee had to get their own fax machine because of all the squabbling that was going on. But you certainly hope that they can settle this because there's a lot at stake.
Right, and you know, both sides said multiple times during the meeting yesterday that ultimately, you know, they want to come to a solution that puts, you know, beneficiaries above all, because that's what they were hired to do, was to, you know, elevate Native Hawaiians in the state and abroad. It's just that with this one lawsuit, you know, they're disagreeing over how to get there, which is kind of surprising because this board has actually walked in lockstep on many other decisions and, you know, instituted a lot of different policies. They started, you know, a new home buyers program. They revamped some educational policies. And so this is kind of like a one blip where they are not agreeing.
Yeah, but it's a serious one if the attorney is saying this makes it difficult to defend what the office does going forward. So hopefully they can resolve this. But what's the next step?
Well, the board yesterday directed those four trustees to withdraw those court documents that side with Ferreira. Whether or not they will actually do so is still in question. They've previously declined to withdraw that already. But whether or not that happens within the next week or so, a state judge in August is going to try to hash out these disputes. And OHA attorneys hope that, you know, that provides guidance on how both sides can, or all sides can, proceed moving forward.
Okay. Well, lots of, fingers crossed that they can resolve this and get past it and move forward.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have to stay tuned. But thank you so much, Blaze.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat's Blaze Lovell. Look for his stories at civilbeat.org. A street psychiatrist based in Honolulu was recently recognized with a top honor. Dr. Chad Koyanagi is a community psychiatrist and one of the nation's few practicing street psychiatrists, meeting people where they are, on the streets, in encampments, and throughout the community. This spring, he received an exemplary psychiatrist award from the National Alliance on Mental Health. Dr. Koyanagi sat down in our studio with the Conversations Lillian Song and spoke about his career. And to note, this interview discusses heavy themes of mental health and substance abuse.
So I have worked in many settings, in quite traditional settings like hospitals, medical school, rural health clinics, working for MedQuest in a more administrative role, working for DOH more recently. But I've always spent part of my time in the streets, focusing my attention and energy to helping chronically homeless, severely mentally ill population, which is a very severe problem in our society. Going back 26 years when I first started doing this work, there were people around downtown who you knew were, at first glance, were quite severely mentally ill, quite impaired, chronically homeless. Now, driving around town, you see these unfortunate people everywhere, like every neighborhood, almost every street has unsheltered folks who are struggling with mental illness and unable or unwilling to get the help they need. So by working in more traditional settings, that has allowed my primary passion of working in the streets to kind of coordinate a lot of the resources that are available. And, you know, whether it be advocating for my homeless patients to be admitted to the hospital, or if necessary, admitting those folks to the hospital I work at, Castle, which is what I do part-time and work there for 10 years. I have a good tool belt of tools that I can use for the folks who need it the most and who are unable to advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so by understanding how systems work, like the hospitals, jails, prison, police, homeless social service providers, I can best understand who is going to be kind of falling through the cracks. And when I meet them and when I'm introduced to them, I can use my experience to best navigate the difficult road that is going to be faced by me and the patient and the team to get the person what they need and hopefully get off the streets, get housing, improve their medical care, and improve their mental health care.
So for you and your team, you have the heart for this, and it really also speaks to the trust that you guys have built up with these patients who are out there.
That's such a huge factor, trust. I can't overstate. In the field of street medicine and street psychiatry, it's one of the most important things, as well as the advocacy and research parts of doing that work. For the folks who are chronically homeless, and even for the ones who have been unsheltered for a short period of time, it's not uncommon. It's probably the rule rather than the exception. Most of these folks have had a lot of life traumatic events going back to their childhood, difficulties with the legal system, racial injustice. And by the time someone ends up on the streets, it just creates an unfortunate cascade of events where people get more victimized, they get less ability to care for their physical protection and health needs and mental health. Other things happen to them, like substance use, sometimes as a survival mechanism to stay awake or to stay protected from other people. So by the time I see some of these folks, they've been unsheltered for 10, 15, 20 years. Oh. As a result, as you can imagine, these folks don't really trust anybody. Mm-hmm. And here comes me and my team strolling along. They've never met me or my team. It takes all of our efforts to build that connection, build that trust. And you can only do that by being predictable, doing what you say you're going to do for them, being where you're going to be when you say you're going to be there, not over-promising stuff for them and having them disappointed. By virtue of many of these folks having untreated mental illness, sometimes, and because of having trust issues, their behavior can be a little bit rough, and they might bark at you or yell at you or say get away or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's par for the course, and probably the more ill someone is, the more likely they are to be that way. And so those are the ones that, like for me personally, I look forward to helping the most, because those are the people that need me the most. And so I spend all my energy to try to get to know them, build trust. Sometimes it takes weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years. And then eventually some miracles happen, like they're willing to go to a shelter with you or work with you to try to find some permanent housing, or better yet, if they're willing to start a long-acting injectable medication, that's going to be a game changer for them. For me, that's the miracle that happens when someone can trust me enough that they would allow me to put a syringe in their arm and give them a medication. That's all based on trust.
It's because you are seeing these people on a regular basis. Like you're saying, it's not just a one and done thing. It takes weeks, months, years for them first to get the diagnosis, but then to agree to treatment. And the treatment is where the change will then turn the boat around?
Yes. So for the majority of my career, we talked about housing first. And I started my career at an amazing place called Safe Haven. It was on Beartania Street, the Edwin Thomas home, that yellow mustard-colored building on Beartania across of the fire station in downtown. That was an amazing place where we would have chronically homeless folks with severe mental illness come in off the streets if they trusted enough to do so, mm-hmm. and we would house them. I think as time goes by, as we have a little bit more research about the catastrophic effects of untreated mental illness, for me, it's been a time to reflect on, like, how, although the trust is paramount and allowing people their choices and civil liberties is paramount, it also comes to a point where standard efforts or even extraordinary efforts fail. I've had some people I've known for 20-something years, and they're still on the street. They're still untreated on the streets because they're not violent. They're not suicidal. And so at a point, you have to realize that there's certain laws that eventually need to be used, like assisted community treatment law. And because allowing these folks to languish in untreated mental illness and homelessness is going to cut their lives short, like 10 or 15 years. They're going to have all these terrible physical health problems. They're brain function is going to deteriorate because of the effects of untreated psychosis. And so kind of teasing out like when and what at what pace and what interventions and what steps need to be taken before choosing more assertive means is kind of the million-dollar elephant in the room. And as to where, as a society moving forward, we need to carefully tease out where those magic points are and not fall into the trap of rushing in with like public emotion and public frustration about homelessness. I think there's a huge tendency in many places across the country, even quite blue states, are falling into the trap of criminalizing and sweeping and creating ineffective homeless programs because other things have not been tried and because people who have all the experience working with the mental health system the way it has been should be listened to a little bit more, I think.
Could you share a story? Your career is over 2 decades long, but a story of hope or struggle that's really stuck with you that you can share with our listeners.
This story has been told a few times, especially with the NAMI community. Mm-hmm. There's a woman that we helped in rural Big Island whose ex-husband had reached out to me and said that his ex-wife was living in a rural part of Big Island and for several years has been essentially suffering from schizophrenia or severe psychosis. So bad to the point where she wasn't caring for her physical needs. Her legs were infected. She was victimized by some random men at one point and rebuffed every opportunity for the family to try to offer her help. I think they had sent a provider out there a time or two, and she just declined care because she was so ill. And then with the Hope Services team, we went out there a bunch of times, building that trust, building that rapport. And with the help of the ex-husband and patient's son, we were able to get her to agree to treatment. And she trusted me enough to accept the intramuscular injection of a antipsychotic medication. And ever since that point, it's been a trajectory towards improvement. And now she's so much better, and she is compliant with her shots and her treatment. Relationships have improved. Her son was able to go away to college, which he apparently was not feeling that he would be able to do as long as she was ill and untreated. And so that's one of the amazing stories that – and I guess the point would be that this family had exhausted every possible traditional means of – getting her help, but it just took the right connection, and my team was able to go out there and willing to help her. And every time we see her, it's amazing. It's like you feel like you want to cry. It's so inspiring that someone can recover like that.
That's a huge turnaround. But it also took the whole village, though, ex-husband, your team, the son, to all make this happen.
Yes.
And so that's wonderful. You mentioned NAMI, and NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Health. And earlier this spring, you actually were awarded the 2026 NAMI Exemplary Psychiatrist Award. And so they say this is a psychiatrist who demonstrates extraordinary compassion, leadership, and dedication to individuals and families affected by mental illness. And you are one of 13 doctors, the only Hawaii recipient to be named. What does getting an award like that mean for you?
It means a lot coming from that organization nationally, but more importantly from the people who run that local chapter of that organization. And I've known people in that organization as well as some of the board members, and they're some of the most respected and respectable people in our community. So for them to recognize hard work that I do and the, I guess, compassion and the probably the most interesting thing probably about me is just the willingness to help people no matter what where they're from or what situation or what kind of insurance. If someone comes to me and says, we're at our wit's end and we tried this and that, we took our son to the hospital, they didn't admit, or we called the police and they wouldn't ask him to get help, and you know, we're afraid and we're going to have to kick him out of the house soon. Like, I can't see someone who knows what to do help these situations, not help. And so I'm compelled to help these situations most times when I'm available. And I think that's what's the unusual part about me.
That was community psychiatrist Dr. Chad Koyanagi and HPR's Lillian Song. He's a McKinley High School alumnus with degrees from Harvard and the University of Hawaii Medical School. Dr. Koyanagi shares that he'd like all of us to have a little more compassion for people and families dealing with mental illness.
Support for HPR comes from Revolusun in Hawaii since 2009, providing energy solutions for homeowners. Learn more about options for backup power when a weather event happens at revolusun.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is an ancient board game that you can learn in 15 minutes and then think about for the rest of your life.
I haven't met a human being yet that plays backgammon that the game doesn't get under their skin. That game will get to you.
Backgammon is back. And why does that matter? You'll hear that next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
An LGBT love story rooted in the plantation era on Maui has been making waves at film festivals around the world. All the Things I Leave You, Patawid, was originally filmed as a six-part web series in Ilocano. The trailer has amassed more than 4.5 million views on YouTube. The film has been reformatted into a movie feature and will be the closing night feature at this weekend's Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival. We spoke with Maui attorney Lance Collins back in December. He's the creator of the film, which had been screened at festivals in New York, Africa, and Asia. Collins explains how the project came to be.
15 years ago, my grandmother died, my Filipino grandmother, and my grandfather gave me, it was just a cardboard box, but it was filled with letters that they had written to each other one summer when they were apart, when they were in their early 20s. And I opened up one and I read it and, you know, very innocent. It's like, oh, I miss you. Please stay true. You know, that kind of thing. And then I decided, what did I decide? I decided that I wasn't going to read any of them until my grandfather passed away. I was like, okay, well, this doesn't seem too private, but at the same time, like, I'll wait. But I did have my nephew scan all of them because I was like, well, you know, maybe fire or bugs or something. So anyways, I didn't think about the letters again. But what it did come into my mind was, okay, what about all of the stories of folks back in the 40s and the 50s who potentially exchange these types of letters, but there aren't grandchildren to receive them, or they weren't, nobody thought to save them, that sort of thing, like the sort of ephemeral history. And so one thing led to another, and then I came up with this story about sort of a modern day love story, but it's intertwined with this love story that didn't happen, didn't end on good terms back in the 1940s, with people sort of not allowing these love letters to go back and forth and so sort of the love story to carry on. So that was 15 years ago. And then we tried to get a director. We tried to get funding. I got Lilia Santiago, who's passed away, but she was a professor in the Ilocano Language and Literature program, which I also taught in. And she was very affected by the story because when she was growing up in Baguio, her uncle apparently had been writing to some woman that he was in love with, and somehow somebody in the family took the letter that was delivered and opened it up and read it, and his love story was uncovered. And, you know, I guess the family, I wouldn't say persecuted him, but she basically said it was not good. And she felt that it was very bad. So anyways, long story short is we tried to find directors. We tried to find funding. We found a director. We didn't have funding. We found funding. The director wasn't interested in anymore. And it was just back and forth. And then eventually Lilia retired and she moved away. And so I thought, okay, well, I guess it's me. And then at around the time that the pandemic happened, I just sort of decided like, well, I think this project isn't going to move forward because like it's taken forever and it's not gone anywhere. So then I ended up doing my partner with Kaylee E. Grace. And that's the Hawaii boys love story that takes place completely in Lahaina. And that was supposed to be in Ilocano. But the problem was when we did the casting call for the Ilocano actors, we got like no responses at all. In hindsight, I think the reason why is that people didn't really know what we were asking for. And because it had the BL term, I think possibly young male actors were thinking like, oh, this is going to be soft porn or something, which it wasn't in any way. We got a PG rating. But Kaylee really put a lot of pressure and we changed to Tagalog, which it isn't Tagalog, right? The Filipino dialogue isn't Tagalog. And I decided that if I agreed to that, which I did, that I would commit to doing this previous story in Ilocano so that there would be an Ilocano film or web series or something of similar length and duration, because I felt a bit guilty that my partner wasn't done in Ilocano.
Yeah, so tell us about the story and why you think that it may be resonating.
The story starts where we meet one of the main characters. His name is George, and he's kind of like a little spoiled rich kid who works for his grandfather's restaurant in San Nicolas, Ilocos Norte. And he encounters this guy who the grandfather ends up immediately hiring as the delivery boy. They needed a delivery boy and a social media manager, and so they hired this. But there's a conflict because on the way to the restaurant, the potential delivery boy basically splashes mud on George. So the other boy is Kiko. And anyway, so they're sort of in this like enemy situation. And then something happens to the grandfather and he ends up in the hospital, and they end up quickly bonding because Kiko's got the motorcycle and can help George basically get around to get the things the grandfather needs. And, you know, the grandfather passes away. And in that process, the two of them end up getting closer by bonding. And then they discover a old cigar box full of unopened letters that were from the grandfather addressed to this person that nobody knows. And then they also find pictures. And the sort of the magical part of the story is that the young version of the grandfather is played by the same character as the present day George. And that's one of the themes, like, oh, you're a spitting image of your grandfather kind of thing. And in these pictures in the cigar box, we find the person looks identical to the delivery boy is the other guy in these seemingly very close friendship or something pictures of these two young men that basically in their present day, it's like, oh, look, it's us, but it's wow. In the 1940s. And then they eventually discover that the other person that's being written to is Kiko, the delivery boy's grandfather. And so there's this story about, you know, like they're trying to get out of, you know, their poverty. And they apply to go to Hawaii, and only Tino, the grandfather, George's grandfather gets accepted. I don't want to give the whole story, story away, but yeah, that's basically where their trajectory goes off into a different direction. And some of the things that you learn is, you know, in Ilocos now and previously, you know, people think of Hawaii as this, you know, milk and honey, you know, roads painted in gold, what are known as the Casa Gloria stories. And what we find in this series is actually the reality, or, you know, the audience is educated on what the reality is. It's exploitative conditions. There were racial hierarchies, you know, racial animus, gendered forms of oppression, that the Big Five had a very specific purpose, which is they wanted people who would work and could be controlled. And they used many means to do that. And so part of the story is basically informing everybody who may not be familiar with that in a way that doesn't seem heavy-handed or just lecturing people, you know, about the past, but that, you know, there are material consequences to that. And one of them is these two young men who, you know, had cared for each other and, you know, had some form of an intimate relationship, basically that the pressures for them to do what they needed to do in their traditional society sort of interfaced with what the Big Five was doing to control labor, and they ended up having an unfinished love story back in the 1940s.
It's interesting, you know, just to hear that the nuance of, you know, the political times and the social culture and what's accepted and not accepted, and the fact that you've been able to blend that story together.
Well, you know, we had a private screening for cast and crew in Ilocos. So several people invited their grandparents, which I was always very little nervous, especially with like my partner when we had the community screenings out in Hana and Molokai. I was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be a problem here. But actually, it's like the older folks are the ones that seem to enjoy these movies the most, because they, I think, see themselves represented in different ways, not necessarily in the, you know, boys love angle of the story, but see their life represented on screen in a way that there's very few representations of Hawaii life or Ilocano life for that matter. But some of these seniors who came to watch the movie, there actually are words in Ilocano to describe the two young men, that relationship that like all of like people who are like under 50 had never heard these words before. And so that was a very interesting after the screening when the people were just talking, that there were terms like ag darling is one of them. And like younger people had no idea, and it was a little bit of a surprise. It's like, oh, wait, there's words for this in Ilocano? So, yeah, so that was the process of the audience basically watching it, and that part of it's also very fascinating, and I look forward to hearing more about those kinds of things.
But at the end of the day, it was a story that rings true. It was authentic, and like you said, it revealed a side of life that older generation was familiar with and knew existed, but maybe kept under wraps.
Right. And I think even in a more universal sense, you know, a lot of the, if you listen to the oral histories of Chinese, not so much Japanese, although there are Japanese stories of this, but, you know, a lot of people's lives and who they wanted to be with or all of that was greatly shaped by the labor management practices of the Big Five. And I think people don't really think too much about, well, people don't think about history much at all ever. But when they do, I don't think people really think about like, well, you know, how is it that I'm like Hawaiian Chinese? Like for a lot of people, what does that mean? And I know a lot of folks who are like Hawaiian Filipino who for different reasons don't really know anything about their Filipino side. And other than the Japanese who had the pitcher bride system, there were these huge imbalances of bachelor societies of Chinese and bachelor societies of Filipinos. And so the choices for like Filipino men were you either marry whoever in Hawaii might be interested, or you go back to Ilocos, or you are a bachelor, or you go to California. And so, you know, that has a significant impact in terms of like how communities, you know, enter into the present is through all of that. And I think this story, even though the two main characters are young men, I think that story about how economic forces shape how people are able to live their lives and the limitations that are imposed that we have no control over or very little control over. I think that's a universal phenomenon. And I think it's something that many people in Hawaii that come from the plantation time are impacted by. So I think it's a universal story in that sense.
That was Maui attorney Lance Collins talking about the Ilocano film, All the Things I Leave You, Patawid. The film's lead actor, Benedix Ramos, and its filmmaker, Jade Castro, are flying in from the Philippines to join Collins at the Hawaii Theater on Sunday at the closing night screening of the film at the Honolulu Rainbow Film Festival. Head to our website for more details. That does it for us for this hour. Tomorrow, we plan to survey the golf landscape. The loss of the century on Maui and the Sony Open at the Wailea Country Club sent shockwaves in the sports world. But the deal to bring the Champions Tournament to Oahu has softened the blow. What do you think of the future of professional golf in Hawaii? Sound off. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.